Welcome to The Art Career, a space breaking barriers by letting you sit in on candid, straightforward conversations with leading art professionals in visual arts, writing, music, theater, and film. I'm your host, Emily McElreath, and I invite you to join me for inspirational conversations with icons of our generation. We dive deep into topics like self-development, career trajectories, mental health, social justice, and the artists that have changed our lives. With each episode, our mission is to empower you, expanding your journey through the arts. Join us for new episodes every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. The Art Career is thrilled to announce its partnership with Glimpse. Glimpse Guides are a collection of luxury guidebooks with an outstanding social mission we are proud to support. Featuring the best of hotels, restaurants, activities, and itineraries for each featured city, Glimpse Guides also include recommendations and travel tips by a curated selection of tastemakers. The most exciting part of Glimpse Guides is 100% of their profits go to Give a Glimpse, which provides funding for educational travel scholarships for underserved students. What is better than that? Glimpse believe that travel is the most important form of education, and it is their mission to send as many deserving students abroad as possible. Glimpse also offers luxury trip design services with VIP perks like early check-in, room upgrades, restaurant and spa credits, welcome gifts, and more. Glimpse has quickly become our one and only travel planner. Go check them out at glimpseguides.com and tell founder Jordan Rhodes that the Art Career Podcast sent you. Roberta Smith is the co-chief art critic for the New York Times. She was born in New York City, raised in Lawrence, Kansas, and earned a BA from Grinnell College in 1969. An alumna of the Whitney Museum Independent Study Program, she worked at the Museum of Modern Art and the Paula Cooper Gallery before becoming a professional art critic in the 1970s. Contributing to Art Forum, and serving as a senior editor for Art in America. In 1981, she became art critic for the Village Voice before moving to the New York Times in 1986. Hi, Roberta.
Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm well. This is a very exciting opportunity for me be sitting here with you,
likewise.
I have to tell you. So I'm going to start with this. One of the most authentic things we can do for one another is to admit we were wrong. On April 17th of this year, you published an article in the New York Times titled, "I Was Wrong About Cecily Brown," to which you said, "One of the obligations of a critic is the willingness to be betrayed, sometimes brutally, by your own taste, whose ins and outs you discover over a lifetime of looking." I wanted to start there because I think it's so important to judge a character based on someone's ability to admit they're wrong and hold themselves accountable. And if I didn't madly love you before this article came out, it really solidified that love for me. And this was in April.
I know.
You know, it was so recent. So I kind of just wanted to start there and, you know, tell you how admirable that was for all of us. What led you to immediately, did you know you were going to write an article like this?
I saw it knowing I was going to review it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't expecting that reaction. My reaction.
And you had it right away?
I don't really remember. I just remember like looking at the surfaces a lot and this subject matter and, you know, her conviction. And, I mean, your mind changes many, many times when you walk into a show. Mm-hmm. You love it, you hate it, you know, and you kind of wait for everything to settle out, see what's the most enduring reaction. But my first reaction was, oh, yeah, this is pretty good. And it went on from there. I mean, the more you write about something, the more interesting it becomes in a way. I mean, that's just maybe a function of ego, like you've invested time in it. But
and that in turn makes it so much more interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I like that approach a lot. And I like your approach to writing so much. Someone called your writing earthy and accessible. I liked that. I don't know if you like that, but I really liked that. And I aim for that with this podcast as well. And I hope I don't quote you too much during this interview, but you're so brilliant that I'm going to. You say, I do object to art that doesn't give you an immediate handle in a visual way. If it seems unnecessarily difficult or obscure, I find it pretentious. Something has to engage you, and that by and large happens in an inexplicable way. And that I find uninteresting. Doesn't involve me for a number of reasons. It doesn't seem rich enough, human enough, accessible enough. And, you know, that in our industry and our world is, you know, there's so much is pretentious, you know, and yeah. So many. I mean, I have a master's in art history and contemporary art criticism, and I'm reading some of this shit, you know, and it's obnoxious, you know, and I make it a point for myself to be really weary of that. And you do such a beautiful job. Has that always been something that's been very important to you, to have this accessibility in your writing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I want to write without footnotes. I mean,
right.
And I had to. It wasn't an option really, but I didn't want to have anything that was sort of over anybody's head. And I wanted the writing to, you know, have a certain pace and give people pleasure and not use huge words, although there are some big ones sometime. But, you know, I never went to graduate school, so I wasn't really exposed to that. And I understand what's happening. You're in a certain kind of bubble. I'm in another kind of bubble. Mm-hmm. But I'm a journalist and I write for a newspaper. And I, you know, I've been happiest writing since I was writing for The Voice and then The Times. But you have a real responsibility to your reader. You know, and I have a crowd of them in all sorts of levels of interest and education. So it doesn't, you know, I don't want people to not go get through a piece because they wear out.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
And I also do think that the primary function of art is visual. I mean, there's lots of really great conceptual art you can refer to, particularly in the first generation. And, you know, I mean, I'm probably leaving out a huge amount of work that I like, but there has to be, for me, there has to be some kind of a connection of immediate understanding or at least immediate attraction.
Visually,
yeah.
When you first see the work of art.
Yeah. I mean, that's not going to, you know, nothing I say can be taken 100%.
Of course, but.
But, I think art offers you this special thing of thinking with your eyes, thinking subjectively, and then kind of, you know, then you take, as a critic, and I think as a viewer often, you then take your subjective reaction apart and try to figure out where certain things are coming from. It's like, you know, a little kind of psychoanalysis.
It's probably very hard to do. It takes...
I don't know. I mean, I find writing incredibly hard.
You do, still.
Yeah. I read someplace yesterday, a couple of weeks ago, someone said, well, it never gets easier. So I thought, okay.
It's okay.
I'm in the belly of this curve.
Well, I think it's important for any of us in our careers to never feel like we have a complete hold on something.
That's absolutely dangerous.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And in addition to that, I don't think you're very smart if you don't have self-doubt, if you have absolute, unyielding confidence in what you're doing or saying. I mean, that's our new Speaker of the House is a person like that. Of extremes and no self-doubt.
That's no good. That's kind of the antithesis of what you stand for and what we're talking about right now. It's necessary to have that.
Yeah, and so you kind of write things with a certain degree of trepidation, like you're not going to say everything that you have to say about a work of art,
right,
if you're lucky. I mean, you like to have a little left over. But you have to reconcile yourself to a kind of, okay, this isn't in, that's, this isn't going in, this isn't going in. And then you just have to say, the reader's not going to really miss these things.
Right, it's okay if I didn't put this
piece
of brilliance in.
Yeah.
I get that, and to be okay with that. This is kind of a exciting and an appropriate bridge. One of my favorite artists is Alice Neal, and you write about Alice Neal. Given the time and her gender, she proceeded along her chosen path much as Georgia O'Keeffe proceeded along hers with almost unbelievable self-assurance. So on the same note of what we were just talking about, as the first woman to ever hold the position that you hold, do you also think you've needed to have that O'Keeffe and Neal have this unbelievable sense of self-assurance, or is that different from what we were talking
about?
Well,
they're artists, and I think that's the way you make your way through the world.
Right.
You just have to have a kind of total belief and then also criticality, which is really a lot to carry. Yeah, I don't know. I had some kind of confidence that the world needed my opinions. I don't know where it came from, really. But I did grow up being always kind of, opinions were important. So I grew up with a certain sense that you should be able to look at something and say what you think.
How was your childhood?
It was okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't great. It wasn't until I got to New York that I got to be really happy. I mean, I love the city so much and everything about it. Well, not everything, but many things about it, starting with the subway system.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said, and I'm not the only one, New York is like my greatest love story, It's just, so I understand that. And yeah, you really own that. You came here and you just completely flourished.
Yeah, more
so
or
you
less,
don't think I you just, were happy until
No, I
you...
certainly wasn't happy in college. And I just, it was really a feeling like, wow, I can be happy here.
Yeah, we talked about that last week a bit, about being miserable in our 20s.
Oh, yeah. That was the worst part, yeah.
Yeah, it's just miserable. And we've talked about how wonderful it is aging as women, because I just get more and more stable and confident and, with it every year.
It's that's just great.
Don't you feel that way?
I'm not sure. I have good years and bad years.
I have good years and bad years too, that's for sure.
Post-COVID has been a little weird for me, I think.
Well, I think you're the type of person... would you agree that your husband's a little more social than you are?
Yeah.
So COVID was probably tough for you, right? I mean, for me, I'm a social butterfly and I came out of COVID with social anxiety. Everything felt weird for me. So what was your experience with that?
Well, we weren't here, which was as hard on me as the isolation. I mean, I just really... missed the city, as somebody said. As I said, I felt feral. I don't know. The New York gallery system is sort of my home. And away from it can get strange, or I can get strange.
You can get strange?
Yeah, I just don't have... I don't know. I mean, I'm very dependent on it. It's sort of my social life, my intellectual life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have relationships with a lot of the people at the front desk.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know? Because they're the ones I see most often. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it was weird because I suddenly realized how completely random my social life is. Do you know that it just depends on who's standing around and in a gallery or sitting behind the desk or whatever.
It's also, I'm sure, and you're, I mean, everyone knows who you are too, so that's probably a nice feeling to walk into a gallery and to have that experience and to have those relationships with the people at the front. You know, it's something in whatever sphere we find ourselves in to be, you know, able to have that is really important. And when you go to the country, you're a true New Yorker. Do you need nature?
Not the way Jerry does.
Right.
I mean, he's always bringing things home when we're up there. Like
a pine cone?
Bird nests. His main goal is wasps' nests, which are quite big. They have a really big one.
How does he know that they're not in use?
Well, I don't think you can find one that isn't on the ground. So, I mean, I'm sure you can, but I wouldn't. So most of them have fallen.
Okay. Okay.
And were abandoned.
And he brings them home.
The Art Career is thrilled to announce its sponsorship from the New York Studio School for Season 4. Founded in 1964 as an intensive studio arts program with an emphasis on perception, artists learning from artists, and drawing as the most direct means of describing one's ideas or experiences, the Studio School offers an array of full-time and part-time programs that prioritize small classes and individual guidance from dedicated instructors distinguished in their fields. It is located in the heart of Greenwich Village in a National Historic Landmark building that was once home to the original Whitney Museum of American Art. The school invites you to join its free public programming, including the evening lecture series, which for more than half a century has been a cornerstone of the New York City art world and can now be experienced worldwide via live streaming. Visit nyss.org to enroll in classes, see what's on in the gallery, register for evening classes, and more. To learn more about full-time study at New York Studio School, schedule an in-person tour or a virtual meeting by emailing info@newyorkstudioschool.org. One day, after reading a review in Art Forum, you wrote a 10-page corrective and sent it in to the editor, right?
Yeah.
This is an obnoxious way for anyone who wants to be an art critic to get started, but if we can cut it in half, we'll publish it.
This is what he said in your words.
Phil Leder.
Of course, he would say that to a woman. I don't know if he would have said that to a man, but how amazing is that? I mean, you had to have had that.
No, that was thrilling, and I'd written the letter and shown it to, I was a secretary to, a really bad secretary to a curator at the Modern at that point. So I showed it to her, and she said, you know, you could be a critic. And that was the first person, and then within a couple of weeks to get that confirmed by Phil Leder was huge.
Yeah, but you had to have known. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's something in the beginning for us where we have this blind confidence where, or it's like nothing to lose. I'm passionate about this and I'm going to put it all out on the table. You can't be scared of rejection, right? Are you scared of rejection?
Yes.
Yes. Have you been rejected a lot?
Well, you know, I was fired from The Voice, so yeah. I've been rejected.
Would you have been fired if you were a man?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Didn't they say to you, you belong at the Times?
Yeah.
And did you know that then?
No, I took it as a high form of insult. So, you just sort of start out in this world and you expand it with one person and one job and one experience at a time, and it gets bigger and bigger, or somewhat bigger.
And early rejection is brutal.
Well, yeah, it is. And it's really good for you in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, because whoever we were talking about before that doesn't have, you know, to be able to be authentic and humble and all the things that come with being very successful and having people genuinely like you, you have to have that rejection.
Yeah, no, I think it was, in the end, I was really glad it had happened.
And we're sitting in your home right now, which is probably the coolest New York home space I've ever been in. This is pretty groovy. And you live here with your husband, Jerry Saltz. You are one of the few people that have been in a successful, committed marriage for a very long time. What has love taught you? What is that experience of commitment to someone in your industry been like for you?
Well, at first I was appalled when he said he was going to be a critic.
Tell me.
Well, I mean, I was the critic, you know.
Yeah.
I was the center of attention. And then he started doing it in his own way, which was completely different from mine. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, we got into this, it's very, very supportive. Like each of us knows what the other is going through practically all the time. Like you get something you pitch gets rejected. Mm-hmm. You meet deadlines. You get back a copy to see their edits and make your own. And it's just amazing. Plus, he's this kind of emotional. He's an empath, mm-hmm. which I am not. He has great kind of emotional instincts and explains things to me.
You do not have that.
I don't think so. Compared to him, I certainly don't. I mean, sometimes I do. But I think he's got all his pores are open all the time, you know, and he's receiving. And I have a lot of times when I'm just like plowing ahead. I've got a show to see. I've got notes to take. And Jerry is back, you know, on the street we parked a car on, talking to people.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And there's never, I mean, because I would say Jerry would agree, he enjoys from time to time being the center of attention, right?
Very much.
Yeah. And was that, because you said that was something that was tough for you in the beginning when he became a critic, is that something that, obviously you two have a great love to be able to coexist like that professionally too, right? That's very rare. So,
I give him all the credit, you know.
Why?
Because I'm very jealous and competitive, you know, and there were certain things that I had to unlearn and get rid of and, you know, just be in a different way. And then once it started, all these advantages came out, you know, like he could read stuff and react to it. He would drive me around to shows. That's always an advantage.
Show for you.
I don't know. We didn't think about it that much.
It just happened.
It worked out, you know, but I really will give him all the credit because I don't think I was an easy person to be around.
Are you an easier person now?
I'm easier. Yeah, I'm more aware that I can, you know, be sharp. And not think about what's going on with the person I'm being sharp to.
That's kind of a lifelong.
Well, marriage is a really interesting thing because it's about witnessing and helping. So there's somebody who's here with you all the time who basically is seeing your life because they're sharing half of it. Mm-hmm. And, I have no idea where I would be if not for Jerry. I really don't. I might have lost my mind, like, 20 years ago, because you know, he was just, He made such a difference to me.
I think he would say the same thing and more about you.
It's pretty equal. And then he forged a critic's career that was completely unlike mine.
And that was lucky.
That was very, very lucky that we didn't really overlap.
And what are the chances, right? It's you two.
Yeah.
Right. Up there. And there's nothing similar there. So that's, it was, cliche as it is in the stars, you know? I mean, it was, that's too perfect to not overlap.
No, we really lucked out.
How long have you been married now?
31 years.
Gosh.
And we were together 4 or 5 years before that. So
a long time. I'd like to pivot for a second and speak to the concept of originality. We've spoken to it already during our conversation. You say, I think each of us has a real capacity for originality, but originality is very, very hard to get to. It takes real work. I think people don't quite realize how much work it takes to be a good artist. The drive and determination and self-criticism. You have to be harder on your work than anybody. So I know that you wrote this about artists.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of think you can plug that into more than just being a visual artist, because I think that that's just such a true statement, you know, that true originality and the capacity for originality very rarely happens. Would you agree?
Yeah, it very rarely comes out, is allowed to come out, or is forced to come out.
Well, what's, like you say, allowed or forced to come out? Just, you mean the opportunity presents itself where that can surface?
Certain kinds of things, yeah. So, you know, if you're a schizophrenic or a possible schizophrenic working on the railroads in California in the 40s, you have a breakdown and you end up in a mental institution where you can make your art. You know, that's Martin Ramirez. I mean, what was driving him crazy? Might it have been the inability to make art? You know, art really will find a way. And I guess I kind of romanticize artists and find them different than other people, including critics. But that's a very broad category, you know, all kinds of musicians and graphic arts and cartoonists. I mean, that's, there's really, if you really take away the divisions between media, mediums, mm-hmm. and hierarchies, mm-hmm. there's quite a lot of creativity. I think artists especially are involved with something that's kind of lonely.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was very lonely, so I understand why artists end up together, that that could be kind of a relief. But the kind of self-scrutiny that's involved, you have to look at what's going on around you, what went on before you, and figure out, how can I make this look like something only I can make?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether you're reacting to stuff to work before you or your contemporaries. I mean, I don't know.
And that's not always good art necessarily. It's just,
yeah, well,
right?
Frank Stella used to say it takes as much work to be a bad artist as a good artist. I don't quite believe that, but he might be right. I mean, you people, they're fiercely dedicated artists who aren't making anything of interest. Or of interest at the moment. I think one of the great lessons of the past 30 years, at least, is that opinions of things change and modify, and you see things differently. So you can dismiss someone who, in 15 years, some younger critic or other eye is going to come along and value. That's one of the, I mean, I think retrieval is one of the greatest things that's going on in terms of revising the art scene, you know, like going mm-hmm. back in history and finding women and black artists,
yes.
and outsider artists. And art's just gotten so much bigger since I started writing. you know, around 1970. I mean, it was minimalism, pop, and a few, like, acceptable eccentrics, like, you know, William Copley or whatever.
But that was it.
Yeah.
I think that just, I want to rewind for a second. You know, I'm very interested in art, mental illness, mental health, the overlap. And you were speaking to that. Have you, I know you are very interested in outsider art. Is mental illness something that you've studied a lot with artists? Is that something that comes up a lot for you? Is that something that's relevant or necessary in certain circumstances?
I really don't, you know, I just look at the work.
Yeah,
and I sort of get it. The stories are interesting, but only if the work is more interesting.
Right, but you're saying sometimes these circumstances can bring about that release of
I mean,
authenticity.
You know, the thing about that kind of art is you can see that it was unavoidable.
Right.
That it was totally compelled to be made. It had to be made. And we sometimes lose sight of the fact that that's the way all art is.
Right.
You know?
Oh, I love that.
And I think artists may sometimes lose sight of it and try to adjust their work to fit more with the fashion. Whereas if they just sort of go with something that they think they shouldn't be making or that will have no pertinence, they'd be surprised, you know. But I think that outsider or mentally ill artists don't have those kinds of screens. You know, if they get in front of the material they were meant to have, they just go. You know, like Judith Scott just sort of is playing around in the art room at Creative Growth, and then there must have been a time when she came across colored yarn and just felt, you know, in so many words, there's a lot I can do with this, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then did it.
And then did it, yeah.
Without any trepidation. I mean, there was just, it's...
Yeah, it's just pell-mell. So it's, I guess it's a very, people like to think that outsider artists are more pure than insider, so-called insider. I think they just don't have as many screens over what they're doing between them
too.
And the work.
I also think mental illness, pain, anguish, however you want to look at it, it kind of just tears down those screens
early on.
You know, I've had my own battles, and there's a part of my work and my personality that I really love and I do think is authentic as a result of those battles, you know? So I think that that's so true. And I love that. You said you didn't have that, you weren't that happy as a child. You became happy when you got to New York. You found your person. You found your place. You became part of a community. And you said, you alluded to that really keeping you grounded.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That was important
for
you.
Well, I'd grown up at a university. And so everything was very hierarchical. And the art world, it was much slipperier, but there weren't these hierarchies. Like, people could, you know, get very famous very fast, and then they might also disappear. But that it was mostly by dint of your own struggle and labor. And that was great, because first of all, then I didn't have to go to graduate school, which I could never have gotten into because of bad grades. And, you know, just everybody learned. I felt like everyone learned on the job, and that art was kind of guiding them to whatever it was they're supposed to do, you know? I mean, some artists negotiate this whole thing and realize they want to be art dealers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. An example. Very visual example being Gavin Brown.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And you figure it out as you go. I mean, I love poetry, and I can't write a poem, and that's okay with me because I love reading it, you mm-hmm. know, and it's kind of finding those little pockets in this world where you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to thrive here. I'm not going to thrive there, yeah. and I'm going to let them thrive there, yeah. you know, and maybe be able to help this other pocket from right here. And it's that's that self-awareness that we're talking about too. You know, it's so important to know what you're good at, and it's so important to know what you're bad at. And I hate when people are like, well, you're not bad at anything. No, you're absolutely bad at things, yeah. you know? And I know what I'm bad at. And I don't waste my time trying to do those things. And I've gotten over the 20-something grief of like, I'm not going to paint the most beautiful painting yeah. and I can't write that poem. It's okay, you know?
Yeah.
Because
I mean, growing up and growing older is a process of narrowing things down. Mm-hmm. Of kind of eliminating what's distracting or keeping you from your work or mm-hmm. all kinds of things. I mean, my limitation is that I don't have a lot to say to people who aren't really involved with art. I mean, I feel like, you know, I live with someone who can talk to anybody about anything, you know.
Yeah.
He barely comes home and he hasn't had a conversation about something. He used to... when he flew on airplanes a lot, he'd always try to find conservative people.
To talk to them,
ask them who they voted for.
Oh my gosh.
Stuff like
that. Would it drive you crazy or you thought it was funny?
I didn't quite know what to think. I mean, he sees every situation as something he can engage in with.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
So I'm much more timid and much more, I like to lurk around in the background and not be noticed that much. Like, I don't have any sense of how I'm regarded in the art world.
Really?
Nor do I have any. No, I don't.
But that's not imposter syndrome. That's just you don't have a sense. Like, what's...
Well, I have a certain insecurity that I try to, you know, hold in place. So that kind of counters it. But I don't know.
I love that. I have
it. It's weird. I mean, I have a lot of followers, but I think they're mostly because of him.
Oh, Roberta, are you serious right now?
Well, we don't have to go there.
No, no, but I mean, I just, you know, you can say this to anyone that you deeply respect, like if you could see you like I see you. And that's, you know, we can never be fully objective about ourselves. It's impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just as well. It keeps you focused.
And humble.
Keeps me focused.
As someone extremely passionate about mental health, seeing a therapist is essential to my quality of life. We'd like to take this moment to announce how thrilled we are to partner with the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp. If you think you might be feeling anxious, depressed, or even just overwhelmed, being alone with your thoughts can be an isolating feeling. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't even have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. It's that easy. Join the 2 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. And just for the Art Career podcast listeners, we will offer 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/TAC. That's better, BETTER, help, HELP.com/TAC. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring the Art Career podcast.
Did you ever want to have children, or would that have just gotten in the way of your career?
It never really occurred to me.
Cool.
I just didn't have it. And I don't know if that's because I didn't have the greatest view of parenting mm-hmm. from my own parents. Or I think I must have subconsciously known that I couldn't have a career the way I wanted one and have children. You know, and I'm just too selfish, basically.
Well,
I knew I would like totally mess them up.
You knew you couldn't have a career, and I think the key in there is you couldn't have a career how you wanted to have a career.
Yeah, particularly at that point when I didn't know what I wanted to do or, you know, how it would go.
Yeah, I love this, and I think this is so important. I love having these conversations with women. Marilyn Minter and I had a really wonderful conversation about, you know, her choice to not have children, because I think there's so much out there that's like, you can do it all. And Laurie Simmons would say, you can do it all, you know, and she did, right? But I don't think everyone will, and I don't think everyone's capable of that. And it's one of those things to, you know what you're going to thrive in, and what if you need to put all of your, if you gain most of your self-love and self-worth by what you're putting out there into this world from your career, which is, it's really important as women for us to own sometimes, you know, then, you know, you have to be honest with yourself that that is the number one priority, and how healthy that is to be the number one priority. And that,
now that's another question, but
what, whether it's healthy or not?
Yeah, I mean, everybody is doing, it's not all, you know, a bed of roses, it's not all completely healthy for you, but
to just be focused
on
that
one thing. Yeah. And that's pretty much what I did. Jerry used to joke, but I realized he meant it. He said, well, you can only do one thing and you do it really well. It's like, you know, can I drive? Not really. Can I cook? Not really. It's just.
But he can drive for you, and you can go to Gristiti's.
Yeah. Do I have any side interests? Not really.
Nothing.
You know, whereas he's seen a million movies and he knows like the history of rock sort of up and down. And I particularly like his interest in music because I'm interested too. But it's wild, or it's because of him that I can watch baseball or football, soccer. He's much more driven and energetic than I am. And he'll tell you it's because he came so late to his work.
Oh, so he feels like he needs to.
Yeah, he doesn't. He tears around here. He can't. You know, he never puts anything away. He's got too much to do. It takes too much time to return whatever that is to its drawer. I came up at a much slower. Like I wasn't expecting speed.
Yeah.
In the beginning,
it was gradual.
So I kind of I don't have any of his. You know, like recently, what did he get interested in? Oh, F1. So now I know a fair amount about
the cars. That show. It's pretty good.
Yeah,
but you would never have found that on your own, right?
I'm a very limited person.
Well,
you know?
Thankfully for all
maybe.
Of us, right?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know.
Again, I don't. So yeah, that's fascinating to me, because even for me, you know, my world is mostly art, you know, and I'll just have once in a while some weekends where I'm like, I don't want to see it.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear about it. I want to watch a trashy reality show and eat in bed and zone out. And I was just thinking about this the other night. I'm like, I don't know if Roberta does that. I think Roberta is always
in it. I zone out.
You do? Good.
Yeah.
What do you do to zone out?
Well, I scroll a fair amount.
Isn't it hard? I know.
And I read.
Yeah.
And I read magazines, and I read other stuff, you know, more elevated stuff too.
But about art or everything?
Well, I have to read about art because of reviewing shows,
sure.
Museum shows.
Sure.
And like right now I'm reading about fauvism.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, that's what you want. It's like you're constantly learning, and it's constantly new areas that I haven't paid much attention to or opening up. So that keeps you going.
Yeah.
And I just think there's something about the exhibition format that holds my interest. You know, I'm very interested in how, where the work comes from, how, well artists are represented. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got these two shows at the Met right now, you know, Durand. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Matisse Durand or Manet Degas, mm-hmm. MD. Mm-hmm. And it's one artist always comes up a bit short. I mean, mm-hmm. I think Manet just shuts down Degas most of the time. Most of the great Manet paintings are here.
Yes.
The same is true with the Matisse Durand. I mean, Durand is the one we haven't seen that much of. And he has his Fauvist work are much, they have a certain range. They have real scale at times. And he loses out once again, you know, because Matisse is just so, in a way, he's just so flamboyant with paint. In this very self-controlled, contained way, you just sort of you don't confuse their work, no. As you don't confuse Manet and Degas when you're walking through that show. Almost never.
No, you don't.
But it's so weird that the Met has done these shows at the same time.
Yeah, it's a weird juxtaposition. It's like what I agree. I agree.
Well, you know, it's important that they put big marquee names up there.
It's the Met. As we start concluding, I know it might seem a little much how much I'm quoting you, but I like it, and it was important for me, and you're a writer. So it's very easy to plan an interview and pull quotes from a writer. You said, and this is very relevant right now on our planet, I've always thought, there is no hate, only self-hate. Most of the hate in the world is something that's being deflected outward. That's why education is so important, a social necessity. If people would really examine themselves or diligently, furiously pursue their own happiness and try not to exclude or control other people, a lot of hate would go away. And I see you as someone that diligently and furiously has chased her own happiness. And that's been such a, because that's what you've done, right, Roberta?
Well, that's what we all do to some extent. I mean, deadlines don't make me happy, but.
There are certain ways
that you pay.
Yeah.
The idea that art education is somehow indulgence or superfluous is just crazy. I mean, people get to know themselves and their own passions through art, through their responses to things. Just to see so much of the country without that, you know, because of what's happened to education, and to see the arts just seen as like recreation.
And meanwhile, art quite literally saves lives, you know? That's
totally.
Something that is so necessary.
Art's really necessary.
And so are you, and thank you for making all of our circuits and our brains come alive, because that's what you do. And thank you for sitting down with me today. It's been such an honor.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Roberta.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of The Art Career. If you get value from this podcast, please consider helping me make more of these episodes by becoming an Art Career Premium member at theartcareer.supercast.com. That's theartcareer.supercast.com. SUPERCAST.com. And please don't forget to rate and review. Every rating counts. Thanks so much.